les podcasts de l'UA.
Bonjour et bienvenue sur le podcast PICT, penser, traduire et représenter les corps, dire l'intime.
Nous sommes Ludivine Bouton-Kelly et Agatha Moringue, maîtresse de conférences à l'Université d'Angers.
Chaque mois, nous interrogeons des chercheuses et chercheurs, des traducteurs et traductrices, ainsi que des artistes, afin d'analyser de manière transversale les représentations complexes des corps et de l'intime dans les arts et la culture populaire.
À travers le prisme de la traduction et de l'étude des représentations, nous parlerons poésie, théâtre, peinture et bande dessinée.
Hello and welcome to this special episode in English of the PICT podcast showcasing the work of Irish writer Donal Ryan. I am François Sablerol, lecturer in Irish Studies at the University of Angers. This podcast was recorded in the margins of a literary seminar on the work of Donal Ryan on the 10th of October 2024, organised by Ludivine Bouton-Kelly and myself at the Arts Faculty of Angers. We had the honour of welcoming Donal Ryan, his French translator Marie Hermé, and Marie-Lou Pirat, his publisher from Albin Michel. You will hear an interview of the author conducted by our master students, Primo Jamet, Marguerite Labanca, Anne Leroy, and Margot Tricht, followed by three readings by Donal Ryan himself. We would like to thank our local research units, Trois Lames, CIRPAL, and SFR, as well as the Irish Embassy in Paris for their support. The event was financed by the Emigrant Support Fund of the Irish government. Enjoy the podcast.
And we wanted to ask you a few questions about writing and teaching as well, since you're both.
Yeah.
So we thought about asking, like, what does inspiration mean to you? Do you think it's a real thing? And where do ideas come from?
Great question. And quite an encompassing question as well. I think it probably speaks to every branch of creativity and life. I mean, I think we all need to be inspired. It just seems to be something that breaks the monotony. You know, some spark that breaks through the quotidian, the ordinary, you know, because life can feel sometimes like a kind of metronomic slog. You're doing the same thing all the time. And I think something that breaks through, something that causes some kind of flash or light or heat in you, can be something that propels you forward as an artist. But it can be anywhere. It can be a matter of reading a newspaper or a piece of writing or hearing something or music or a conversation, a snatch of conversation. I remember years ago I was running and I passed two people who were having a conversation. There definitely is a moral quandary here, but I heard part of the conversation. And it seemed as though this guy was asking this woman to have an affair. Now, this is what I got from it, I'm not sure. And I just got a very small snatch of the conversation, but the woman was very striking. She was an African lady and she spoke with a kind of a Central African accent, and he was very Irish and he was a very big, stocky man, and he was kind of towering over her. And I ran on and I thought, what's going on there? Seriously. And he was holding a bucket that was filled with cleaning implements, like small little brushes and sprays and stuff. And so I wrote a story. I stole what I saw that day, but I was very inspired by the people, by their body language and the way she was standing and the way she was looking at him. And she was her gaze was very level as she spoke, and so I stole the whole thing. But I found that moment to be very inspiring, you know. And people as well. I mean, people who have a certain view on the world that's unexpected, startling, I think, will always move you out of your own prejudices and suppositions, you know, into a different way of thinking. Because I think it's so important to be as open-minded as possible to other experiences. And I think that's almost the essence of art, to try to express something about this whole project of existence, of life, you know. I mean, project's an awful word, actually, a very uninspiring word. But that's the point. I mean, and it's all around us, it's everywhere. And I think just being open to it and being alive to it, you will be multiply inspired in any moment that you exist. You know, you can find inspiration anywhere. Oh, recently, actually, I was in a town in England called Leeds, and I went for a walk through the city before my event, and I found this tiny church on the outskirts, and a flagstone on the ground outside the church with this verse that was written in memory of a 12-year-old child who had died sometime in the 18th century, and it was just so heartbreaking. And I stood there for ages, just staring at it. And I don't think it was inspiration, but just I was so profoundly moved by these words that had been created all these years ago in mourning for this child. It was just so beautiful. It seemed to be this couple's only child Oh God, it was amazing. These small moments in life, I think, can be extrapolated so much. They can be extended so much.
So it's experience and like circumstance and happenstance, really. But is it also sometimes research? Like, do you go into places you want to write about, meet people you want to write about, or?
You know, I made a big mistake once of saying that I was a lazy researcher. And that quote, I see it recurring over and over again. Oh, it's terrible thing to say. No, I shouldn't have said it. I was a bit drunk, to be honest, at the time. And I just won an award. And there was money attached to the award. And I was just so happy. I would have said anything. And somebody asked me that night, a journalist, about research for the book for which I'd won the award. And I said, oh, I'm a very lazy researcher. But I didn't qualify that. I should have followed up by saying, but I always make sure to do the research, even though it pains me to do it sometimes. But very forensic, assiduous, detailed research I find to be very hard work. And especially if the subject isn't, you know, something I'm interested in. But when I wrote my novel From a Low and Quiet Sea, I saw that quote in a review in The Guardian in the UK, saying Donal Ryan is a self-confessed lazy researcher. But they didn't know that for 7 years before writing the book, I had communicated weekly and sometimes daily with people from Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and various places around the world that were war-torn and from where people were seeking refuge in Ireland. So they didn't know this, because all they knew was that once I had said, I'm a lazy researcher. But it's so important. It really is. Kit DeVal is a great writer from the UK, and she's a good friend of mine. And she once wrote an article about this, actually. And she said that it's very important never to dip your pen in somebody else's blood. But she wasn't saying that you shouldn't ever write somebody else's experience. She was saying you must make sure you do it right and with sympathy and something at least approaching love for your fellow man. That you don't just take a certain set of tropes or cliches and apply them to your prose or your work. That you make sure you know what you're talking about. So even if it's the dish a person might eat on a certain day from a certain background or tradition, you know, it's important to describe the dish properly. And to make sure that somebody from that place or that background or that context who reads it won't feel affronted or won't feel that you were lazy about it. I think it's really important because, I mean, the annoyance I feel when I see Irish people portrayed lazily, I can imagine how it must feel to have, you know, really negative stereotypes applied to you. But when I see, you know, a drunken Irishman, you know, who loves his mother too much and, you know, swears a lot. I mean, I have these characters, but I think for me it's authentic. But when it's done lazily and just as a kind of a throwaway method of portraying an Irish person, I feel very affronted. So I never want anybody else who reads my work to feel affronted by my representation of their place or language or time or whatever.
It's definitely important. And not only about the place and the character, but about the subject that you choose to approach, do you find yourself changing your mind or evolving with the society, or how do you know which subject you want to?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not really sure. I just find that sometimes something will be kind of bugging me, you know. And just to go back to the same example again, that novel From a Low and Quiet Sea, one of the main characters is a Syrian man who is seeking refuge in Ireland after making a journey from Syria to Turkey to the island of Lesbos in Greece. And he's lost his daughter and wife on the voyage. And I mean, again, like, this is stolen. I appropriated the story. I mean, I read a similar story in a newspaper and the story seemed very clipped and perfunctory and curt. The language that was used was the language of reportage. So necessarily they were saying, these are the facts. This man lost his wife and daughter on a voyage in a substandard boat from across the Mediterranean. And he was a surgeon in Syria. And he was told by the traffickers, it's going to be a high-quality craft. You know, we'll get you safely to Greece. And from there, you can claim asylum. And you're a surgeon. You know, they'll snap you up. You'll get asylum in any country in Europe you want. And he believed this. And so, but the enormity of his loss, I didn't feel was fully expressed. It couldn't be fully expressed in this very short and very clearly written article. And so I really wanted to express something about that. And I said the best way to do it is to fictionalise it. You know, to have this character in a novel who loses his family and who tries to claim asylum and who isn't believed. Because he was saying, people, I have nothing. I've got no papers. I've got no records here. The university where I studied is destroyed. Everything is gone. Nobody even believes I'm a doctor, you know. And he had to try to find some way of making people believe he was who he was. So he lost his identity as well as his family. And he was kind of a ghost of a man. But I tried my best to immerse myself in that context. And so I studied very hard. You know, I tried to express something of what it must have been to live in a town in Syria in that time as the civil war broke out, and how society changed so rapidly and fundamentally, and how all of a sudden these extremists were taking over the streets and telling people how to live. And all of a sudden violence was, for these peaceful communities, violence was now an everyday occurrence, and people had to run from their own homes. And I really was careful about being really forensic and detailed about my research. And I knew that nearly all of the research wouldn't make it to the book, because it couldn't, because it's a novel, it has to be compressed and economical. But I needed to have an understanding. But having said that, you're never going to know. You're always guessing. There's no way of knowing for sure how it feels to be somebody else. And that's, but fiction is the act of trying to express another experience in as real a way as possible, even if it's never something that has been close to your life. Just trying to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. It's a very fundamental part of the act of creating fiction.
Well, as we saw before, you have a so-called bad language in your books, very raw. And do you often wonder how your books will be translated, you know, if it will be an accurate and easy process?
Yeah, you know, when I wrote Spinning Heart, I mean, I had written my first novel first, The Thing About December. And Spinning Heart was published first. But when I wrote this, I had no expectation of ever being published, because the first novel I'd written had been rejected by pretty much everybody. Every agent and publisher just said no. So I said, oh, feck it, I'll write another novel, just so I won't be, you know, dissuaded by the rejection. But in writing this, I said, I'm going to use as authentic and real a Tipperary demotic voice as I can, because I want to represent that on the page just for myself. And I didn't consider the reader at all. I just considered me getting this polyphonic novel finished, so I could say, I finished two novels. That'll do. That's fine. I've done the thing I said I was going to do. And because my first publisher was quite, a liberal and very small volume and very high quality literary press, they changed barely anything about the book. And so the vernacular was abstruse and opaque to lots of readers, and for translators, I'm sure it was very difficult. But I said, I might as well stay in this vein now, because it's working. I won't write something that to me feels inauthentic, because it'll make life easier for a translator. Now, which is very mean. I know it sounds very mean, but I know, because for me, translation is a dark art. I have such huge admiration for translators. I don't know how to do it. But I noticed, actually, with later books, that I would get emails from people like Mary and, you know, my Japanese translator, and people around the world would have a big, long list of really good questions. And it seemed to me as though they were sometimes reframing passages to suit the demotic speech of their potential readership. So, and you'll nearly always be able to find some kind of similar phrase or word in the native place. And also, I think some of the arcane phrases will be, their meaning is revealed by context. You know, you might know what the words are or what the phrase means, but the context of the phrase and who's saying it and when they're saying it nearly always will reveal the meaning. So I was kind of thinking, that's what I'll do. You know, I won't make too much of an effort to make life easy for anybody else. I'll make it easy for me to write it. It's very selfish, you know. But that selfishness, I think, adds to the sense that the words are on the page as they would be used in the place. But that itself is artifice too, because no one will ever actually speak the way you write, you know. So you have to try and inhabit this strange middle ground between vernacular speech and prose, because prose and speech are different things, you know. Even dialogue, even when you write direct dialogue in fiction, you know, people probably won't speak exactly as you write the dialogue. You know, the dialogue will have to serve the story or serve the scene, you know, and people will use subordinate clauses, and they'll use words, and they'll use resolved sentences generally in dialogue in a book, whereas in ordinary speech we'll speak in fragments and single words, you know, and we won't bother to arrange our clauses nicely, but you have to in dialogue for a book, because it needs to be some way understandable. So it's all a big game of artifice, you know. It's all artificial, none of it's real, but it has to feel real.
But it still feels real to you, because you've mentioned how there's such a stark difference between how you used to write in the beginning, thinking there was one way to do it, and then actually making it authentic to yourself. And nobody else can do it but yourself when you want to be authentic and true.
That's so true. I mean, like, it's like the whole idea of striking your note as a writer is very important. But some writers never strike their own individual note, and they write in a way that's redolent of other writers, and it's completely fine, and they're great writers, you know. But for me, when I was doing that, it didn't feel right physically. I used to have a strange physical reaction to what I was doing. I'd feel slightly sick, and I'd feel a little bit, you know, my colour would go a little bit, you know. So I was actually making myself actually physically, literally sick by not writing in an authentic way. It was so strange. And what I look back on now with disbelief is that I persisted for so long, for so many years, trying over and over again to do something I just couldn't do. It was very self-defeating. But still, I think it was a very hard and long, arduous apprenticeship, you know. And maybe if I'd taken a course or done an MA in creative writing or some kind of course, someone might have said, why are you writing this voice? This voice doesn't make sense. It doesn't ring true for you. This is not your voice. But having said that, again, you know, I mean, mimesis is important. It's important to be able to write in other voices that aren't yours as well, of course, as I had to do with Farouk and From a Low and Quiet Sea.
And so it's great that you mentioned teaching creative writing, because I was going to ask you about that. So is it something that's important now to your writing process as well? Do you get something from it personally?
Oh, it's a great question. And I do think a lot about this, actually. And I wonder, because the last, I think, 5 books I've written since I have been a teacher of creative writing. And I don't know if I would have written those same books in the same way if I hadn't been, because when I wrote my first few novels, I never considered the technicalities of the act of creative writing. I just wrote by the seat of my pants, you know, and I was thinking to myself, sure, I've read thousands of books, you know, I've served my time as a reader. I know how to do it. I know how a story works. I know how a story is constructed. You know, I've immersed myself in this variegated world of fiction, you know, and I know all of these tricks. I've learned these tricks from the masters. So now I can apply some of it. And sure, I couldn't really, you know, I mean, it was pure luck that I got to write Spinning Heart and The Thing About December in a way that was in any way semi-coherent. And so when I started to consider the fundamental aspects of writing and the things that need to come into a sentence in order to make the sentence resolve, I started to worry a lot about my sentences. But I think that worry fed into a kind of development. You know, I started to write, I think, in a more considered way. I don't think I could have maintained the kind of furious pace of my first novels. I couldn't have maintained that kind of carefree attitude either, because when I wrote them, I had no expectation money-wise or publishing-wise or anything else, you know. But I had to be slightly more circumspect going forward, because, I'm sorry for using the phrase going forward, it's terrible. But when I wrote every novel after the first two, I was paid in advance, which is terrifying, because now someone has invested money and you need to honour their investment, or at least try your best to do it. And so I do think that at the start, being a teacher of creative writing caused me to overthink, you know, because in class I was considering the elements of a piece of creative work in isolation and discussing them in depth. I started to think about them, you know, and I started to read books about creative writing, which isn't always a good idea, to be honest, because they are so contradictory. And so many of them are very didactic. They'll say, this is what you must do. This is the list of rules. And there can be no list of rules with art. Absolutely. I think rules and art are anathema to art. I think you should be free to express yourself. But still, I think you do need to apply some kind of template, some kind of form to your work, because especially with writing, if you want it to be read, what you write must be readable. So you're not completely free.
And so when you're writing a book, do you maybe have a routine or a way to organize yourself? Like some writers will say that they will write like 1-2 pages a day. Do you have objectives? Do you have a way to organize yourself?
Yeah, this is very boring now, but what I do is I get up early and I force myself to write a certain number of words, and I will decide the previous day how many words I need to write the next day in order for me to feel as though I've made good progress. And the number is usually around 2,000. I think 2,000 words is a really good day's work. But having said that, two good friends of mine, Anne Enright and Jennifer Johnston, who are really inspiring people and great writers, both say that their day's work is 500 words, and that's a really good day's work. And it is, because if you consider it, actually for Anne it's 300 words, because a 300 words is an average paragraph. And Anne says, if you write a paragraph of average length every day for a year, at the end of the year, you've got this lovely, considered, well-worked draft of a novel. Because a paragraph is such a small piece of work. It can take 10 minutes or it can take 5 hours. But, you know, either way, you're going to make sure it's a good, well-written paragraph. And for people who aren't full-time writers, who have so much else going on in their life, to find the time even to write a paragraph a day, you're doing very well. But anyway, I say to myself, OK, I'm going to write my novel in the next 12 weeks. I generally give myself a 12-week period in which to write a first draft of a novel. And I'll write every single day, and I'll try to write X amount of words every day. And I'll spend at least 3 hours. But after 3 hours has expired, I find myself getting a bit weary from it and a bit over-immersed, and so I break from it. But before I start, I will do anything not to write. Like, I will vacuum the floor in my attic where I write over and over again. I'll complain about my son's friends putting marks on the floor. I'll go downstairs to tell my son I'm pissed off over the marks on the floor. And then I'll start playing guitar, and I'm a very bad guitar player. But I'll play riffs like from Led Zeppelin and AC/DC over and over again, and I'll try to master them. And I'll say, well, I can't start writing until I've mastered this riff. I have to get it right. It's terrible. And then I will sulkily approach my desk and go, oh, I just hate this. I hate this. Why did I ever say I'd write a book? Same thing every day happens. I don't know why it is. And I resent being a writer for about an hour. And then I spend 2 hours writing, and it's great. And as I was saying earlier, after about 15 words, everything's fine. I know what I have to do. But I do think it's very good to have at least a vague idea of what you want to achieve story-wise in that session. You know, I generally say to myself, I need to have my character go to this place and meet this person and do this thing in this next section. And that's going to take around 1,200 words. And then my explication of that's going to take maybe 500 words. So I'll have a vague plan for the day. Something will have to happen that day. And when you make progress, it's just the best feeling. You know, you feel such relief.
Well, and in that stage of creation, do you approach the story the same way, whether it has 21 voices, like your latest, or just one? Or...
You know, I love the polyphonic form because it's not as oppressive. This wasn't an oppressive book to write. The book I wrote before it had one main character, and it was written in a very close third-person voice. So it's almost first person. You're inside the character's head all the time. You're seeing the world through his eyes all the time. And it's in third person for a very good practical reason, because it has to be. And I found it oppressive. I found it hard work. You know, I persisted because Anne-Marie was so in love with the character. And also I couldn't go into the living room because of the TV show she was watching that I kept interrupting. And so I had nothing else to do in the evenings. But I do approach a story the same way. I'll still have the story at least vaguely planned out, and I'll know what's to happen. And so if it takes 20 voices to tell the story or one voice, the story is still very important. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes gets forgotten, especially with literary writers, the primacy of story, like and the reader's desire to be told a story. It's something that goes back to our babyhood, you know, and I think it's... Narrative is something that's encoded in our human DNA. It's something that separates us from other species. Our ability to narrativize things, you know, to make sense of this incomprehensible world with narrative. It's a very human thing. And so people love to be told a story. It's why, like, the avant-garde anti-narrative novelists are admired but never read. Nobody wants to read it because everybody wants to hear the story. I mean, it's why Ulysses is so amazing, because Ulysses is all those things. It's avant-garde, it's an immersion in linguistic gymnastics, but still it is a very clearly a story about a man's grief. And it's one man's walk through his day, and you are told the story of that man's life in that day. It's amazing.
I was wondering, because you're known for impactful sentences and, like, very... When we read you, we know, like, you thought about the word choice very carefully. And so I was wondering if you're the sort of writer who speaks, or even screams, some writers do that, their sentences aloud to see how they sound and try to, you know, perfect every choice of word, or don't you?
I do, yeah. I think it's very important, actually. Absolutely, because it's amazing how sometimes a sentence can look okay on the screen or on the page, but when you read it, it feels out of balance. And that tensile strength of a sentence is very important to me. That a sentence feels as though it's sinewy, that it won't fall apart, that it resolves somehow. And even when I write very long, you know, anapractic sentences that are joined by punctuation or conjunctions, I still need each constituent part to have a balance and a resolution. And reading aloud really will reveal to you things you can't see sometimes. It's amazing, actually, what you can see when you read aloud. And also, like, basic things like repetition. It's very easy to be blind to your own repeated words until you read aloud and you go, oh my God, I used the word fence like 10 times in a paragraph. And then you go back and change things. It I see this all the time, actually, repetition. And even in some published novels, you go, God, they should have found it. They should have spotted that word is overused in that chapter. But having said that, I mean, we all have our own singular voices and our own preoccupations, and we all have words we overuse, to be honest. But reading aloud is a great idea. It really, it also makes what you write feel real. You know, suddenly it has this presence on a screen or on a page and also in your ear, you know. It's amazing.
And also you describe yourself as being haunted by voices and ghosts, and also as well as being impacted by your family and your background. Is writing about this subject cathartic, or is it a way of honouring those voices?
Yeah, that's a lovely way of putting it, actually. And there absolutely is catharsis to be found in fiction and in writing and in basing fiction sometimes on your own experience. Like, the glib advice is often given to younger writers to write what you know. And that is good advice to an extent. But I think we also should make sure that we write towards what we don't know, to try to discover something about the world. But when it comes to, like, for example, this book, my grandmother is in this book. She's very present. The character of Mary Aylward is my grandmother's voice, you know. And it's not her story, but it's definitely her voice. And she's the woman in the book is a woman very like my grandmother, and she speaks in the same way. So I channeled, like, I could hear my grandmother's voice in my ears as I wrote, and I could see her face, you know, and I gave the character the face of my grandmother. And it was lovely. It felt as though she was back in my life in a very real way, you know. It felt as though she was, I could hear her voice again. I could almost smell her. It was amazing. That lovely, you know, perfumey smell from the 1940s. I don't know what kind of perfume it is, but it's an amazing smell. I don't know what it is. Some kind of concoction they had in those days. But it's lovely. That's lovely, you know, it really is. And I mean, like, I didn't really suffer any trauma until I hit my 40s, and then all the trauma of life seemed to happen in the same few years. I hit this moment where I couldn't create at all. I was kind of in stasis. I couldn't move forward. And I thought, like, the only tool I have at my disposal to make sense of all this is fiction, is my creative practice. And eventually it became a really, really effective way for me to sublimate those feelings into something outside of myself. But having said that, I often was a bit gung-ho about this. I was often a bit thoughtless about it. I'd say to young people in schools, oh, writing is very cathartic. You know, you can really work things out. If something's worrying you or bugging you, you can write it out. But another writer said to me, that advice is fine, but you have to warn them about the power of language and about what can be unlocked very quickly. You know, and how traumatizing it can be. You can actually be re-traumatized by expressing your trauma in language because you live it again. You know, and so she said, like, be careful, you know, and make sure to warn people. So it's not always the best advice for somebody, you know. It's not always the way forward. You know, I think it should be approached with care, absolutely, because language has such power, words have such power. You know, as limited as language is, you know, you can start to relive things that you might be fully prepared to face in that moment. In Israel, in the town of X, a man walks each morning to the end of his street, where the desert begins. It is how he wakes, standing just before sunrise, the air cold and sweet. He does this to feel the dark and gather his calm for the talk he must have with his neighbour, a retired colonel who sees the next Holocaust slam in from every direction and for the day's labour. He also walks after sunset and stops outside to listen to a nocturne played well by a young girl. He mentions that instead of peace, and the old man's pride softens him. His daughter's daughter, so musical. Reading this, the good habit of taking peace where we find it, knowing it will be scorched by noon, and holding it inside our dark cistern makes more sense than roadmaps. Walk on, Amos Oz. Okay, so this chapter is called Proposal from the Queen of Dirt Island. Chris proposed to Mother on an evening in early summer with his working clothes on him, as though he'd been seized suddenly by some amorous impulse, some wild desire that had been lying dormant. He came rushing down from the fields to the village, half-cocked, as Nana said later, though she didn't wholly disapprove of his hastily conceived and poorly executed plan. He stood a long while at the side door, mumbling. Saoirse had never seen a redder face. Mother had stepped back to let him in. She had a cigarette just lit and she was pulling on it deeply. "Come in, Chris," she said through a cloud of blue smoke. "Or I won't, Eileen. My boots are covered in muck. I won't drag it in along your clean floor." "Or clean my arse," said Mother, and Chris laughed a high chuckle the way he always did. Chris enjoyed Mother and she liked him right back. From somewhere, from the ether or the blue heavens, or the fumes of new growth or agricultural diesel, he drew courage and he made his proposal. "Eileen, I was wondering," Saoirse heard him say. "Wondering what, Chris?" "I was wondering if 'twouldn't be the best thing for all concerned if you and me, if I and you, if you and I," and then he said it straight, nearly in a shout, "will you marry me?" Saoirse saw Mother bend forward as though someone had struck her in the stomach, and she grabbed in her two fists the lapels of Chris's overalls and pulled him into the kitchen, slamming the door closed in the same movement. Chris's eyes were opened wide in shock. Whatever he'd been expecting, it wasn't to be manhandled off his feet. He straightened himself and put a hand over his face and drew it downwards as if to reset himself, to regain something of his passive countenance. "What kind of rubbish are you talking, Chris?" He didn't know, it seemed, what kind of rubbish he'd been talking. But on he ploughed. "We wouldn't have to, you know yourself, be married in the fullness of the word. We'd just, you know yourself, take the bad look off of things. You'd have, you know, a bit of company, yourself and the baby." "Baby?" Saoirse was 11 years old, and she opened her mouth to protest this slight, but some vague wisdom rose from within her and silenced her. Paddy and Chris called her the baby, and maybe they always would. "I love you dearly, Chris," said Mother, "and I'd be a lucky, lucky woman if I were free to marry you. But I'm still in my heart and soul married to your brother, and I will be, I'd say, for all of eternity." Chris said it was okay. He was sorry. And Mother said she was sorry too, and she kissed his cheek. And Chris dragged himself back up the hillside, and he didn't come down again for a long, long time. Okay, so this is from the chapter July in The Thing About December. Johnsy knew now what it was like to be in love. One way, hopeless love, he knew, but still love. They'd had a stand-in teacher one time inside in the tech. A little blonde lady, straight from university. She was a fine thing, all the townie boys said, and they gave many a break time over to discussions of her body and how she was definitely gagging for it, and how you could definitely see her nipples pointing out through her blouse and her bra, and that was a sure sign she was mad for it. Johnsy admired her brave talk, but secretly preferred her pale green eyes to any other part of her and the soft sound of her voice. She read this poem in class one time. Johnsy never forgot what it was called, The Dong with the Luminous Nose. It was about a woeful, ugly creature called the Dong, who was head over heels in love with a beautiful woman who could never return his love. His love for her was unrequited. Miss had written the word on the blackboard and underlined it twice, and Johnsy had not forgotten the spelling nor its meaning. Unrequited, not returned, not given back. The whole class stayed quiet for that whole long poem, and afterwards, instead of guffaws and smart comments, there was only a strange sort of silence, like some kind of desperate sickness had befallen lads who only a few minutes previously had been full of the joys of spring. He was one of the thickest lads in that class, but even Johnsy knew what she was at. That little blonde lady from the university, that shining angel among all those dirty devils. She was telling them all they were only a shower of lovesick dongs, and she knew full well how they talked about her. But she also knew each one of them was some way in love with her, and they could sail away in their little boats and drown themselves in a sea of longing for all she cared. She'd never return their stupid, sweaty love. It was unrequited.
Thank you very much again to Dawn O'Ryan and to our students.
Merci de nous avoir écoutés et merci à l'Université d'Angers et à l'Académie Pulsar de la région Pays de la Loire pour leur soutien.
Vous pouvez suivre l'actualité du projet PICT sur notre carnet hypothèse. À bientôt !